Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and happy January. We are well into the month, and we are going to do, this is kind of like our new year topic.
It is. It's a tradition.
It is.
But we're doing a little bit of a twist on it.
First,
unless we run out of time, or we have too much time, rather, we're not going to do this day in history, and we're not going to do your word that you're bringing back.
Yeah, so don't tell us we messed up.
That's right.
Because this was purposeful, because we wanted to chat about some fun things. I mean, the predictions, too, are...
That's the new twist.
Yes.
We've always started the year, although we started this year with cuteness.
The Quila kids, yes.
Trying to boost our ratings, and I haven't checked to see if it did it or not. But we always start with things that are turning 100 this year.
Yeah.
But we're also, because I was looking at 1925 and the things that were invented, the companies that started, the products, things like that, I stumbled across some predictions in 1925 of what the future would look like.
Oh, okay. Good.
So I kind of thought those would be fun. And so let's talk about predicting the future.
Okay.
So here's some thoughts from back in 1925, what the future looked like.
Advancing age. Thanks to science, people would live to be 150 years old. Sir.
Would you want to live to be 150?
No.
Sounds awful, doesn't it?
But in 1925, that's okay. Sir Ronald Ross, a British doctor who received a 1902 Nobel Prize in Medicine for his studies on malaria, told a London audience that life expectancy would continue to increase because of scientific advances. That miraculous progress will not stop, he said. A great scientist at the Pasteur Institute in Paris has said that in 100 years, man should live to the age of 150. Why not? A famous American doctor suggested to me that we should all be immortal. Who can tell what scientific investigation may bring? No one can say how long we may live when we are free from the ravages of germs. Free.
Germs.
Free. Okay. The advances of medicine and surgery will have had been such that most of the ailments and limitations of old age will have been eliminated. Life will be prolonged at its maximum of efficiency until death comes like sunset and is met without pain and without reluctance. There will be no death from disease, and almost any sort of injury will be curable. I do like that sentence.
I do like the sunset thing and
yes.
Pain-free.
Death comes like a sunset and met without pain and reluctance.
Yeah.
I'm
down with that, but just not at age 150.
150. Well, I mean, yeah, no germs. I mean, did they also not think that the population would grow?
Oh, we'll get to that.
Oh, okay. All right.
So British scientist Archibald M. Lowe expected the 21st century to offer television machines.
Ooh, okay.
Breakfast tubes.
Interesting.
Automatic sleep beds. Wireless banking.
Oh, okay.
Nailed it. moving sidewalks and one-piece suits made of artificial felt.
Sounds terrible.
Sounds like a jumpsuit to me.
Here are some other ideas from Lowe's 1925 book, The Future. Waking up on time. A very useful service will be the radio alarm clock. Signals will be sent out at frequent intervals on different wavelengths, say between 6 a.m. and 10 a.m. every morning, and setting the alarm clock to catch the signal at the desired time will avoid any risk of oversleeping. House and public clocks and even watches will be synchronized by signals sent several times daily, and we shall then know the right time instead of finding a variation of minutes all over a small city. But does that mean we all wake up at the same time?
Yeah, it sounds like maybe. I don't know. So women in science.
Ooh.
Women, owing to their accelerated development,
oh my gosh,
will compete on equal terms with men in all branches of scientific research, resulting in faster progressive developments for health, comfort, and speed of thought and life. Many of the new discoveries of the future will doubtless be entirely due to the sex at present referred to as the fairer sex,
wow,
a term they will scorn in days of real equality.
Well, we're still working on that.
But I like that whole sentence.
Yes.
I mean, they're basically saying, come on, women are smarter.
Yes.
And someday we'll all realize it.
I like this one too. Airport of the future. The air traveler will walk into a comfortable and well-appointed waiting room in the center of a city. An elevator will take him up to the roof where he will step direct into a roomy and really comfortable airplane cabin. There will be no bumping over a hilly aerodrome, but the machine mounted on a turntable will be shot off into the air by catapults. Oh, wait. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's space at over 300 miles an hour.
Catapults.
Okay. Well.
I like that. And these, of course, are predictions from 1925.
Yes.
So Professor Lowell J. Reed crunched the numbers. Things did not look good.
Ooh.
The Johns Hopkins University instructor warned that the United States would face a food shortage in 100 years.
Okay.
So we're all hungry out there.
I mean, eggs, right?
That's right. He predicted that the U.S. population would reach 200 million by 2025.
Oh my gosh.
He was a little off because it's 345 million or so. In 1925, it was only 115 million.
Okay.
It's kind of interesting. He thinks 115, it's only going to go to 200.
Huh.
Reed said that the nation would have to find new sources of food to feed all those mouths. This new food supply must be either found in the tropics or provided by processes for making artificial food from organic substances, Reed told a conference in Williamstown, Massachusetts. The latter would not be practical unless the cost of chemical processes were rendered much cheaper than they are at present. He'd probably look be a little relieved to know that modern grocery stores are stocked with tropical fruit and lots of processed food.
I mean, it's kind of interesting because he said that the artificial food would be made from organic substances.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, we'll see. But how about those eggs? Have you bought eggs recently? I had to buy some the other day. And there's $10. You're like, but I haven't stepped in a grocery store.
No, of course. But I just laugh that... You know, I mean, if you'd asked my father 30 years ago, I can't believe a candy bar is a dollar.
It's true. Or more. Right. True. But eggs. Okay.
Those chickens, you know, have to be reimbursed for all their hard work.
Speaking of and more, Dr. A.R. Wentz, a professor at the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, anticipated these advances by 2025. A substitute for sleep would be found. Its chief ingredient would probably be acid sodium phosphate.
See, I don't understand that. I almost did a little more research on that one. Does he think we're just not going to sleep?
That's sort of how I read that.
Yeah, I like sleep.
Chemistry would be used to produce synthetic foods, making them chiefly out of nitrogen from the atmosphere. Chemistry is involved. People would use pocket-sized apparatus for communications to see and hear each other without being in the same room.
Nailed it.
Bingo. There would be world peace, a common world currency, and universal free trade.
Nailed it.
Oh, Mr. Dr. A.R. Wentz.
He was very optimistic.
He was.
Well, I mean, sleep thing.
It's kind of funny, those other things, and then this one that's so whimsical.
Yeah. So the end of poverty.
Oh, okay.
If society made this a concerted year. Effort, poverty would be abolished by 2025. So this is the year. This is the year we're going to abolish poverty.
Okay.
Sophie Irene Loeb, president of the Child Welfare Committee of America, said the continued advancement of widow pensions and child welfare laws would help achieve that goal. Once juvenile poverty was eliminated, the next step would be to address poverty among adults. There should be no pauper child in this country, and no able-bodied child should be anywhere except in its home, Loeb said. The children our future citizens need and are entitled to not charity, but a chance.
Oh, I like that.
I like her too.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is the year. We gotta do it for Sophie.
Yes. These are called knee slappers from 1925. Horse-drawn vehicles are fast disappearing from our streets, but jackass-driven automobiles will still be with us 100 years from now.
I like that.
I just said that on the radio.
I know. I was surprised you started that one. I was going to read that one for you.
Oh, okay.
So the daily and hourly progress of madness and folly and wickedness will at least make a fine narrative in history. But probably the people of the future will have so many follies of their own that they will not care greatly for ours in 2025.
I
still care about their follies.
Yeah, I mean, we are talking about it. Those who fear that the world will be overpopulated a century hence may underestimate the capacity of moonshine. That's a funny one.
That is a funny one.
They are now celebrating the 100th anniversary of the invention of the detachable collar. Judging from the popularity of divorce 100 years from now, they will be celebrating the invention of the detachable marriage yoke.
Oh, those crazy people.
I don't even know what that is. The marriage, a marriage yoke?
Well, just like you're married.
Just marriage. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Married. Because the divorce thing is just too rampant in 1925. Oh, okay. They're just like, really suspicious of it.
Well, yeah, that worried. World peace never happened. Yep.
All right. So what was happening in 1925? That they were thinking these things about the future. So let's talk about some things that are turning 100 this year.
Okay.
So these are all things, obviously, that started in 1925.
Got it.
So in October of that year, the Grand Ole Opry.
Oh, I love it.
Launches in Nashville. The iconic Grand Ole Opry, a legendary country music radio program and live concert venue, was inaugurated in Nashville, Tennessee, marking a pivotal moment in American musical culture.
And I went there.
Did you?
And my big takeaway was that it was really small. And that they used church pews, which somehow escaped me all those years. And everyone's like, you didn't know they used church pews? But they do. And you're, I mean, because you're given a ticketed seat with a number, mm-hmm. but it's a pew, right?
So you could just slide over if you wanted.
Kind of. I mean, and it was absolutely packed and there wasn't even like a big, big act. But yeah, that's fun. Okay, 100 years. Burma Shave was introduced in 1925 by the Burma Vita Company in Minneapolis, owned by Clinton Odell. The company's original project was a liniment made of ingredients described as having come from the Malay Peninsula and Burma, hence its name. Sales were sparse, and the company sought to expand sales by introducing a product with wider appeal. The result was the Burma Shave brand of brushless shaving cream and its supporting advertising program. Sales increased. At its peak, Burma Shave was the second highest selling brushless shaving cream in the U.S. Sales declined in the 1950s, and in 1963, the company was sold to Philip Morris. Its well-known advertising signs were removed at that time. The brand decreased its visibility and eventually became the property of the American Safety Razor Company. In 1997, the American Safety Razor Company reintroduced the Burma Shave brand with a nostalgic shaving soap and brush kit. Though the original Burma Shave was a brushless shaving cream, and Burma Shave's own roadside signs frequently ridiculed grandpa's old-fashioned shaving brush.
So, obviously, if the signs kind of disappeared at 63, I do not have firsthand knowledge of them, but I almost would have said I am familiar with them because of my parents talking about them. But do you know what they're talking about in the road signs?
No.
You're too young. They would have these little road signs like every 50 feet, 100 feet.
Oh.
Get your Burma Shave now at the next turn off.
Oh, interesting. I mean,
these little tiny signs, and it would just go on. So you'd be reading this whole sentence.
Okay.
As you were driving along.
Oh, man. So, yeah. Sounds pricey.
Yeah. Well, they were little.
Yeah.
All right. So I don't have anything on it, but Corona beer.
Okay.
If you're a beer drinker.
Introduced.
Like Corona was introduced. Goobers.
Nice. Yum.
I like saying goobers. Goobers were introduced in the United States in 1925 by the Blumenthal Chocolate Company. Ward Foods acquired Blumenthal in 1969, and Ward Foods was acquired by Chicago-based Tersan Company in 1981, and then Nestle acquired the brand in 1984. Do you like Goobers?
Are they the ones with
raisins? I think
this
is raisins, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
I'm okay with chocolate-covered raisins.
Sure, of course. Honey Maid, the Pacific Coast Biscuit Company of Seattle, later named National Biscuit Company and shortened to Nabisco, first introduced Honey Maid in 1925. The recipe used honey as an ingredient, which was not the typical recipe at the time. They were first introduced as Sugar Honey Maid Grahams and renamed Honey Maid Graham Crackers in 1965. Nabisco also made a cookbook based on the crackers in order to promote the brand.
I like graham crackers.
Sure. I know it's shortened now, graham crackers.
Yeah. Well, I think it actually still says Honey Maid on them.
Well, that's
the box. I don't know.
That brand does, yeah. But there are several other companies that make graham crackers, yeah. Right?
So Mr. Good Bar.
Nice.
Although the Hershey Milk Chocolate Bar with almonds had been produced since 1908, Milton Hershey initially did not want the Hershey brand name associated with a chocolate bar that contained peanuts.
Oh. Huh.
So I wonder what his problem was with peanuts. So it was introduced as being produced by the Chocolate Sales Corporation, a fictitious company name created by William Murray. That's just funny to me. It is currently available both as an individual product and as one of the varieties of Hershey's miniatures. So, funny thing, I've laughed, you know, the little Hershey miniatures that you can get. And at some point in the last few years, which is why this one made me laugh, I was like, Mr. Goodbar, is there even such a real big size candy bar called Mr. Goodbar? And then I saw them everywhere after I thought about it.
So there are.
So we were laughing that they are actually still around. So during the Great Depression, sales of Hershey's products dropped by 50%. Milton Hershey, determined not to let it affect his employees and the town he created for them, refused advice to lay off workers. Uh-huh. Instead, he directed the company to find an alternate means of bolstering revenue. The company began a marketing campaign promoting the candy bar as a protein-rich meal due to the peanuts it contained.
Oh, wow.
Coupled with a new price of 2 bars for a nickel, reduced work hours, and canceled bonuses, the Hershey Company came out of the Depression in a strong position, and by 1936, profits had reached a level 10 times that of the company payroll.
Interesting.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, now I'm curious, too, about the chocolate. I wonder if he just do like Hershey chocolate, and that was it?
I kind of think so.
And so then when they started to branch out, he still realized. Wanted that brand name.
I just like the peanut chocolate bar as my dinner.
Right. Yeah, sure.
It's healthy.
Protein. Napa Auto Parts also entered the picture in 1925.
Yeah, I don't have any history on them.
Yeah.
But 100 years ago, I like Napa Auto Parts.
Yeah, of course. Winn-Dixie, which is a grocery store. Winn-Dixie was built up by William Milton Davis and his sons, Artemus Darius Davis and James Ellsworth Davis, Milton, Austin Davis, and Teen Wayne Davis.
I kind of love those names.
Yes. William started the business in Burley, Idaho, where he bought a general store in 1914 that he later named Davis Mercantile. As was common then, he sold most goods on credit. The advent of cash-only grocery stores in the 1920s hurt Davis's business as the new stores offered lower prices and larger selections. In 1925, he borrowed $10,000 from his father and moved to Miami, Florida, where he purchased the Rockmore Grocery. In 1927, the company was renamed Table Supply, and 4 more stores were opened. In 1931, the Davis family bought the Lively Stores chain for $10,000 to create a chain of 33 Table Supply stores across Florida, from Miami to Tampa. William Milton Davis died in 1934, leaving his 4 sons in charge of the company.
Okay, so I had to think about this, adding this one in here. And I'm assuming not all of our listeners have only lived here.
Right.
How far widespread is Winn-Dixie?
It's pretty widespread.
We never shopped at it, but I
Florida.
Knew of it.
Yeah.
And is it just a Florida thing or is it around the country?
No, it's definitely the South for sure. But yeah, it's big. It's big in Florida. But I'm confused here, though. So when did it actually become Winn-Dixie?
Yeah, that it didn't say.
It's sort of like buried in there.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know that they.
But the store, the grocery stores.
They start in 1925 because that's when he buys the one in Florida.
Okay.
So the first motel.
Oh, cool.
1925, the first motel opens, the Milestone Motel Inn, and it's MO-TEL. So Milestone Motel Inn in San Luis Obispo, California, built by architect Arthur Heinemann, a hotel designed specifically for drivers. The name is a shortened term for motor hotel.
I like that.
Okay, so hotel or motel? How would you define
it?
Okay, yeah, I wasn't asking for that. How would you define the difference?
A motel has outdoor doors and a hotel is indoor.
Exactly. That's the way I've always defined it. And obviously, I've had an argument once in my life.
Did you lose?
No.
You won.
Well, regardless, I'm correct because you just backed me up. So I am correct. But if you have a choice, which do you prefer?
Oh, always the indoor.
Yeah, me
always.
Too. Okay.
Always.
All right.
Yes, I think the last time I stayed at a motel was probably in college. And, you know, you make poor choices when you're younger.
Yes.
Howard Johnson's. The restaurants originally started as a single location, opened by Howard Deering Johnson in 1925, and grew into a substantial restaurant chain in the decades that followed. By the 1950s, the company expanded operations by opening hotels, then known as Howard Johnson's Motor Lodges, which were often located next to the restaurants. Throughout the 1960s and 70s, it became the largest restaurant chain in the United States with its combined company-owned and franchised outlets.
I loved, as a kid, Howard Johnson's fried clams.
Oh, interesting. I would never have known that it was the largest.
Yeah, that caught me off guard.
I mean, it's 60s and 70s, but still,
McDonald's is going by then.
Right.
Burger King. Okay. So, all right. 1925, Sears, Roebuck & Company expanded its catalog business by opening its first retail store in the merchandise building, its headquarters in Chicago, Illinois.
We've talked about that one before.
Because I love Sears.
Okay.
And I worked for it as a kid, and then former city councilor, Russ War.
Yeah.
And I bonded because he worked for Sears for many years.
Oh, interesting.
And he was kind of surprised that I knew some of the history of Sears the first time I met him.
Well, and then their catalog still kind of remained a staple for years, right? I mean, decades past that.
And of course, I've raved about my Kenmore refrigerator.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
On the air many, many times.
April, The Great Gatsby, published by F. Scott Fitzgerald's his seminal novel, The Great Gatsby, was published, marking a significant moment in American literary history. The book would go on to become a classic 20th century literature, capturing the essence of the Jazz Age and the American dream. Oh, I loved it. I know you're shaking your head.
I mean, I get it's good literature. It's an okay read. It's a good story. I just don't think it's all that.
I like almost all of his writing, but they're very similar. He's very poetic.
Yes.
So I do think that the movies don't do it justice because they are very depressing topics, even though it says it's not, right? It says it's capturing the essence of the Jazz Age. But it's, I mean, it's hard. It's hard living during those times. So
peering at the
if
light
you
across,
read it, don't watch the movies.
Sound.
Yeah.
All right. February, though, of that year, 1925, the New Yorker magazine debuts.
Oh,
the first
nice.
Issue of the New Yorker magazine is published, marking the beginning of a significant cultural publication that would become an influential voice in American journalism, literature, and commentary.
Oh. In November, Charles F. Brannick files a patent for the Brannick device for measuring shoes.
So,
who knew it had a name?
I was going to say in Jeopardy or something. I would never have gotten that one, but there's an actual name for measuring.
That's why you got to think of better names for things like that.
Yes.
Just using your name, which is what all white men do.
Yeah, I don't feel the need for that.
That's good.
I don't quite know why.
But we do have a Mac Burns Day.
Well, that's not my fault.
That's true.
Just because I'm beloved by the community.
Just because it's you.
I can't control that. All right, the electric shaver.
Ooh.
And we had the Burma shave earlier, and now we got the electric shaver.
Competing.
Yeah, well, Jacob Schick suffered an injury at an Alaska gold exploration while he was searching for gold. He experienced many pains when he tried shaving his beard. While he was trying to
I know, I was wondering where that headline was going.
Yeah, so I don't know why he had to shave his beard when...
I know.
I don't know if it was the actual shaving of the beard, if it was like his arms were hurt and he couldn't reach up. I don't know.
Also, when you're talking about razors, don't lead with that you suffered an injury.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. So with time on his side, he had plans to come up with a design featuring a shaver with a head powered by a flexible cable and an external motor. That seems very complicated.
Yeah.
So he tried to do it and it was all bulky and he couldn't really do it. And then he went off to World War I. And it was during his the work there that he saw some of the military stuff. And he was like, hey, after the war, he went back to design a magazine repeating razor. He started his company that produced his electric razors afterward and was always working to develop the first prototype.
Interesting. And I mean, Schick is still around today.
Yeah.
Okay. The aerosol can also came about in 1925, invented by Eric Rothheim. Before this invention, spraying liquid or gas was impossible. It took the intervention of Eric, a chemical engineer from Norway, to invent a possible model for spraying cans. It's now known as the aerosol can. His experiment was first conducted with a nozzle, which he named aerosol can. After successfully inventing the aerosol can, he sold his patent to a U.S. company for $17,000. Today, aerosol cans can be made from tin or aluminum. A can dispenses a kind of liquid filled in it together with some pressurized gases, which could be butane or propane. And by pressing the nozzle at the top, the liquid is transformed into gas and released from a tiny hole in the nozzle. Aerosol cans can be used for different purposes and can contain different substances like paints, insecticides, spray perfumes, and the like. And of course,
gotta say, I like aerosol cans.
Hairspray. Mm-hmm. Hello.
So if you've traveled, of course, Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport. It's turning 100 this year.
Oh, okay. It's a busy airport.
Yeah. And then Caterpillar. 100 years ago this year, the Caterpillar Tractor Company was formed from the merger of two companies, the C.L. Best Tractor Company, founded by Clarence Leo Best, speaking of guys naming the things after themselves, and the Holt Manufacturing Company, founded in 1890 by Benjamin Leroy Holt. Holt's industrial roots came from his work with steam tractor machines. Starting in 1890, he built his first experimental steam traction engine, nicknamed Old Betsy, and followed that up with a steam-driven tractor capable of hauling 50 short tons of freight at 3 miles per hour.
Wow.
Because the because the steam tractors of the 1890s and early 1900s were extremely heavy, sometimes weighing 1,000 pounds per horsepower, and often sinking into the earth, Holt attempted to fix the problem over the years with various innovative ideas. On Thanksgiving Day, November 24th, 1904, the Holt steamer, number 77, with a continuous track that kept the wheels from sinking into the mud, was successfully tested. As the story goes, company photographer Charles Clements, looking at the machine's upside-down image through his camera lens, commented that the track rising and falling over the carrier rollers looked like a caterpillar. And Holt seized on the metaphor, "Caterpillar it is! That's the name for it!" So there's a long history, though, of how the two companies get there, but they merge in 1925. And today, Caterpillar Tractor Company is the world's largest manufacturer of construction equipment, with 2023 sales and revenues of $67.1 billion. Its single largest customer is the U.S. government.
Oh, interesting. Chrysler, also. Walter Percy Chrysler was an American industrial pioneer in the automotive industry and the founder and namesake for the American Chrysler Corporation. Kansas-born Chrysler, the son of a locomotive engineer, was connected to the transportation industries throughout his life. His love of machinery prompted him to forsake a college education for a machinist apprenticeship at the age of 17 in 1892. He then spent the next 20 years working his way up the echelons of railroad engineering, developing a reputation for his creative mechanical mind and tireless enthusiasm. He did not enter the automobile business until 1911, when he was 36 years old and met Charles Nash, then the president of General Motors. Nash persuaded him to join GM as the manager of the Buick plant in Flint, Michigan. Then in 1915, GM founder William Billy Durant made him president of Buick. Durant and Chrysler did not always see eye to eye on business matters, and a year later, Chrysler left Buick and went to work for Maxwell Motors with a vision to create an advanced, well-engineered car at an affordable price. In 1928, Chrysler purchased Dodge Brothers and later that year introduced the first Plymouth model to compete with modestly priced Fords and Chevys. So Chrysler retired as president of his company in 1935, though he stayed on as chairman of the board until he died in 1940.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the party.
So Progresso.
Oh, nice. Soups.
Yeah, soups and
other foods.
And tomato sauce. That one's really long and we're running out of time. But I like that it actually started in Italy and then went to New Orleans and then went to New Jersey.
Oh,
and then that's where it really kind of exploded and grew. And then Chalamet perfume.
Which I've never heard of.
You never heard of. See, I didn't really hear of it. But then when I saw the picture of it, I was like, oh, yeah, I recognize that.
Okay.
So...
I like the line here. Today, we nostalgically remember the scent fondly as the fragrance worn by our grandmother.
That's exactly it. And then Mrs. Smith's pies.
That's
frozen
great.
Pies.
Yep. Still
is that ringing a bell?
It is. Yeah.
I had to think about that one.
Yep. Okay. So they started that in her kitchen in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Okay. Well,
so
this year in history, 100 years ago.
I'm curious what people would be thinking about we predicted in the future.
Ooh.
Where are my flying cars?
Exactly.
Jetsons promised me flying cars.
I know.
But now I second guess that. As a kid, before I drove, I thought that was cool. But now as a driver, what was that line that you had about all the donkeys behind the
steering wheel? Yes, so, yes.
All right. Thanks for listening. Go make some history. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for an adventure in history. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.